You're listening to Super Yacht Radio.
And welcome to the Devil's Advocates. We have a full house today. First of all, I will say hello to my co-host, Walter Schmidt in Zurich. Walter, how you doing, my friend?
Dave, I'm doing fantastic as always when I'm with you, as you know.
Aww.
And how can it be different with such a body on my side? Come on, that's watching.
I'm feeling a little tear coming on. Well, you've brought a guest today, so I felt obliged to bring a guest of my own with me today. And I should introduce my guest first. It is the wonderful Maeve, who many of our listeners know. And now, who have you brought to the lair?
Well, this is a man. This is somebody. It's not just somebody. It is the one and only. Not only real estate artist, also author on 7 books, which the newest comes out very soon, which you can also order. You should order it with a very special name. And this person is nobody else than Frank McKinney. He is someone. You have to know him. You have to know what he's doing. You have to have his books. And I thought he's a perfect fit for this show because he's so much shape and so much value.
If you don't stop talking, we will actually never get to meet him.
We will meet him.
I was going to say,
very
actually,
welcome.
Welcome, Frank. Welcome
McKinney.
To Super Yacht Radio. Hey, drum roll.
Hello,
hey, Maeve. Hello, Dave. Dave and Maeve. And Walter. Walter is not only my public relations person, he's also my lawyer. So we're going to make sure that we behave today.
No chance of that with Dave.
We will be going to lots of breaks while we confer with the lawyers as to what we can and cannot say. But Frank, I will start off by saying we read your bio, of course, before the show. And I was thrilled to see that we have something in common.
Tell me what that might be.
I'm wondering too.
You are male, aren't you?
We have the same hairstyle, I see.
Well, I just figured that we both shared maledom, and that was about it. I don't know where to begin. Walter, where shall we begin?
Well, let's make it just easy, as typically life should be. If you want to start a good one, then first of all, welcome Frank in a very special way, as you did already, one more time, and then just get started with maybe the question, what is he doing actually? Who is he and what is he doing right now? And then let's take it from there on.
Well, actually, if you don't mind, can I ask, Frank, how did you emerge into the Frank you are today? Because very briefly, you're a real estate artist, you're a publisher, as Walter was saying. You're also quite an accomplished athlete. You're a very driven man and very inspirational. What was your journey to where you are today?
I start my new book out by the name of Aspire with a line from the movie Rocket Man that says, you must kill the person you were born to become the person you want to be. And that's what I did. I killed the Frank McKinney that was born in Indiana in a small town to a family of 6 kids, 4 sisters and a brother. My father was a banker. My grandfather was a banker. Therefore, I was supposed to be the 3rd generation banker. And Dave, I got on a plane with a $50 bill and a 1-way plane ticket when I was 18 out of high school. And I flew to Florida to become what I am now. I didn't know it then, but I am now I build houses on the ocean, on the Atlantic Ocean, on speculation. So I build them without a buyer in mind. And that real estate artist name was given to me by the Wall Street Journal and the Forbes magazine, where I create this artistry on a sun-drenched canvas, 3-dimensional art that you can live in. And I create them without a buyer. And I've done 44 houses on the ocean with an average selling price of $14 million. Mind you, there's no education behind me other than a 1.8 grade point average coming out of high school.
So can I ask, Frank, first of all, I love that line, the imagery of you getting on an airplane with $50 in your pocket. That is a line in a country song that needs to be written. But a real estate artist. So as you say, you don't have training, so... I take it you're not an architect, but you design, say, the conceptually, this is what I want it to look like, this is the living space I want, and then an architect puts that into a plan, then you build, or is that how it works?
You know, I kind of grabbed onto that real estate artist moniker when the Wall Street Journal and the USA Today had given it to me, because, you know, I always... enjoyed in growing up and even as a young adult and into my, you know, my age today. I love art, all forms, performing art, three-dimensional art. I love painting, I love sculpting, but I can't do these things. I'm not doing them very well. I realized my talent, my professional highest calling was yes, as you said, creating this artistry that was three-dimensional that somebody could live in. And so I do design the houses. Although you're correct, Dave, I'm not an architect. I also take and I design the marketing around the sale of these houses with the average selling price of $14 million. So, you know, that part, I get to be an artist. I get to actually express my artistry, my creativity, and I get paid very well to do it. But doing it all on speculation, which gives me the excitement, really, of not knowing when I'm going to get paid. And I haven't known when I'm going to get paid for over 30 years.
Well, I'm the same. So that's two things we have in common. But we won't go into that.
But well, you should maybe, Dave. Maybe that, you should.
That's a new show. But I mean, there is a certain confidence in that these are waterfront properties, obviously in very desirable locations. So it's.
And are they also based just in the States, or have you kind of designed things in different places around the world?
No, Maeve, I believe in digging or carving your niche a little deeper and a little wider than most, meaning I stay put. I learn my market. I know it's Palm Beach County that I work in, Palm Beach, Florida. And I put about 3,000 miles a year on my car, meaning all of my artistry, if you will, all the houses I build and design, build and sell are within 8 miles of the treehouse that I'm coming to you from today. Actually, yes, for those of you who are visual, you know, close your eyes and Dave and I are coming to you. Or I'm coming to you from a treehouse today where I design all the houses I build and write all my books from.
It's more like a log cabin that's in a tree. I mean, a treehouse, it's where I come from, is a cardboard box that's stuck between two branches.
It's a nice tree house. I'll tell you that it has a bathroom, a sink, a shower. It's got a king size bed right above me. It's all 220 square feet. So it's quite small, but I believe in creating a space that draws out your creativity and ingenuity. And I'll tell you a little secret. I had not written a book until I built this tree house. And I've written seven in six different genres. And some of the beautiful oceanfront homes I've designed over the last 20 years have come right. Again, we're radio here. You can't see us, but I've come from right this desk I'm sitting at. And if I just lift my gaze up just a degree or two, the Atlantic Ocean is with the rolling waves are right outside my window.
We did see that. And could I ask, what kind of tree is it?
Actually, it's in two different trees. It's called a strangler fig tree. Is part of the tree, and then if you can well see behind me, that is a sea grape tree, which are very those two are native to Florida.
Okay. Can I ask Frank just to bring you back a little bit? You know, when as that young man, I mean, you are very accomplished in many different fields, but were there sort of a few big turning points that helped the transformation for you early on? Because you know, if just sort of looking at your philosophies in life, it's everything from, you know, nutrition and exercise and your relationships. But there's also, as we've discussed, a very creative side. You're quite well rounded, for want of a better expression.
For such a slim man.
in many different areas. But were there kind of a few nuggets that started the whole process? Because for many people, they become very strong in one particular way, but you have, you know, really diversified in your life in different ways.
There's two answers to that question. The literal answer is that the big turning point for me was I was a troublemaker as a young boy, and I was in a juvenile detention, which is a place that kids go before they're 18. Before you go to jail, you go to juvenile detention. I was locked up like six or seven times. And God, you know, it takes a while. He takes a couple times to hit me upside the head with a baseball bat. And the last time I was there, it was 17 years old. It was a few months before I moved to Florida. And I realized I cannot do this anymore. And I took out really, again, visually imagine an eraser. And I turned around to the chalkboard of life and I erased what was and got that duffel bag full of everything I own and got on that plane and left Indiana for Florida. Yet when I landed, though, Maeve, I realized that most everybody I've met, And people I've watched, you have four daughters, I understand. Mm-hmm. We're taught that we are either right brain, meaning creative, or left brain, meaning analytical. And this is untrue, this is unfortunate. I was trained and meant to believe that I was analytical. My father was a banker, grandfather was a banker. Therefore, I'm going to know business. I'm going to know spreadsheets and I'm going to know numbers. Well, that's what I was when I landed in Florida, and I engaged the right side of my brain. It took years for me to awaken the synapses in the right side of the brain so that I could be both creative and a businessman. And that maybe I think is what has allowed me to toggle back and forth in nanoseconds between the right brain and the left brain when it comes to all the involvements that I'm in. You know, is let's design the world's only jellyfish aquarium, which I designed, but let's make sure it makes business sense in this $15 million house that I'm building. And the people that I look up to, you know, people that you may know as household names that you might admire, they have that ability to toggle back and forth between right brain, left brain. And that's allowed me to live somewhat of a life of a Renaissance man, where I'm able to be very good at a number of things, both business-wise and creative-wise.
Wow. Good answer.
Yeah, I'm staying quiet on that one. Did you notice that?
I see that that everybody is just really listen and listen deeply into what you say, Frank. So that means a lot. That means also that it has a great impact. And that's awesome. Appreciate that.
You know, when you told me pre-interview that you have four children, do your best to awaken both lobes of the brain, because it makes for a wonderful life. And I don't know where I would be if I was. I would be very unhappy, I think, if I had to stay in Indiana and I was going to be this banker. I have the capability of doing it. You know, I had a 1.8 grade point average in high school, but I had A's in math. And the reason I applied myself in mathematics was because I knew someday I was going to need to count money. A lot of money, my own money. And so I purposely did well in math, and I did well in English and in creative writing, because I believe if you could have just pictured these simple six words together, speak well, write well, equal sign, well respected. So if you can speak well, you can write well, you will garner respect. And those are things that didn't come natural to me at all. And so I had to work on those things. And I have a daughter as well. I don't have four of them. I have one of them. And I've instilled those. What's that?
It's a start.
It's a start. I know she's 22 and I think we're probably done. But I envy the fact that you have four children. I wish we were able to have more.
Well,
We can ship, can't we?
It is one of the gifts of children, is that they are still very, and my 9-year-old, she just turned 9, but she reminded me of this. She's like, you know, I'm not going to stay like this forever. And because she's seen teenagers, she can see the next stages ahead of her. You know, I will go through teenage years where I won't really want to hang out with you as much. But then on the other side, I'll really like you again because I'll be, you know, older kind of.
I just want to point out this was while she was negotiating to sleep in with mum and dad. And she was pointing out that she's only 9 and this won't last forever. Very good argument.
One of
very good negotiator.
Is very much, you know, you need to appreciate and capture this moment in time because it will change. And there's the, I'm still just very playful and very creative right now. And that for parents is the gift, as you know, from your own children growing up, is the gift that children have in being able to allow you still be creative and still be playful and still be a bit more focused on you know, time right now. But just going back to what you were saying about the right and left brains, I think that's a just very interesting point, since we do tend to focus on, you know, for many people, much more on the non-creative side that's seen as a softer skill.
On the easy side.
So just to bring you on, because you're also a very well-published author in different genres, which is interesting as well. And can you kind of step us through that process? Because writing is also something that is a gift in itself and an interesting thing to have gotten into in different areas.
So, yes, another thing, let's go back to childhood, where when at least in the United States, we're taught from a very early age, read, like reading, must read, you must read. And this is important. And I'm not saying you shouldn't read. Reading's more reactive. Writing is more proactive. It engages parts of the brain that you have to you know, you have to be creative. You have to think. I've written novels. I've written two, you know, fiction books. I've written now five nonfiction books. And so to me, writing was therapy. Most good books that I've read, I have to read twice because it takes a while to absorb with me. I just am a slow learner. But when it came to writing, my first book was, believe it or not, a philosophical book. I sold my book to a publisher based on the real estate success I had, but I decided to make my first book called Make It Big. Well, I'm looking at you, but we're on the radio. I'm thinking we're on TV. Here's Make It Big. This is a way different hairstyle, but this book came out about 20 years ago.
That's a beefy book. It's quite thick.
It's very thick. Most of my books are, you know, 300 to 400 pages long. The new one will not be. That was philosophy, Maeve. So I wrote a book on philosophy. My publisher said, you did really well with that book. It sold a lot. It still sells a lot. You're a real estate investor. Why don't you write a real estate book? So I said, okay, I'll do that. So I wrote a book on real estate. And then I wrote a spiritual book. Then I wrote another real estate book. Then I wrote a young reader fantasy novel that was, now you'll love this, with four daughters. This was based on the fact that I walked my daughter to school every single day from pre-K to eighth grade. 1,652 times, consecutive times. She never sat in the backseat of a car when she was growing up. And we walked through my house here. You can see behind me, there's, you know, these sea grape trees, and there's a tropical jungle behind me. We walked past a nature preserve over a drawbridge every single school day of her life. I took those adventures, those games and stories, codified them and turned them into a fiction book called Dead Fred, Flying Lunchboxes and the Good Luck Circle, which was competing with Potter, Twilight, Hunger Games, and Narnia. Then I left that and I wrote a Christian romance novel based on a passage in the Bible that it really jumped out at me. And then this most recent book is called Aspire, How to Create Your Own Reality and Alter Your DNA, which is a mindset.
I like the launch party and the kickback to Evel Knievel.
Oh, for the new book, Yeah. So in my new book, one of the first few chapters, I asked the question, who do you aspire to emulate? Because when you really look up to somebody and you aspire to sample parts of their DNA and absorb them into your own, that process can be very fun. And I look back over my life and I realize that, you know, the characters that I aspire to emulate, some weren't even real people. They were fictional characters, like Willy Wonka was one I aspired to emulate. Robin Hood, I get to play a modern day Robin Hood with what I do over in Haiti by building these villages. And Evel Knievel was one. He could have been a fictional character, although he was real.
No, he was real.
And really, he was real. And his risk-taking, his showmanship, his brand-building ability was second to none. Oh, and this whole huge industry.
It was global. I mean, there was a whole era of Evel Knievel. And,
there wouldn't be extreme sports without Evel Knievel today.
No, he was in a world of his own. I don't think anybody competed with him on stage.
It just became a term. You know, if you were messing on your bike, your mom would say, are you doing an Evel Knievel?
Evel Knievel, yeah. Yeah, but I was fixated on him, and not just for his stunts, but just for his way to mesmerize a crowd and make you sit on every word he said. And he was a multimillionaire based upon his ability to sell himself, not necessarily the fact that he could, you know, jump a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about Aspire. Interesting name. Rather than Inspire, it's Aspire.
Very important. There's a reason. I will tell you, in a nutshell, motivation washes off and goes down the drain with the soap at night. We as a species, as human beings, were not wired or meant to be or stay motivated. So don't beat yourself up.
I am so with you on that. I mean,
Dave, no more beating yourself up over the fact you cannot stay motivated.
Thank you.
I can't. None of your listeners can, and neither can you. Neither can you.
Could you give me a moment just for a second there? Did you hear all that, love? Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that resonated with my co-host. Carry on.
And he can't be motivated. All right. So if we did a poor job today by motivating your listeners, we failed. Because tonight, they'll take a shower and everything we said will wash off and go down the drain with the soap at night. That moves me to inspiration. Now, inspiration, you could watch an inspirational movie or read an inspirational book, and that will last about as long as a bad sunburn. So, you know, 2 weeks later, and it's gone. And this is really almost a postmortem on my life. I'm not dead yet, but I look back and I say, wow, I can't stay motivated. I can't stay inspired. but it's the time that I aspired to be a best-selling author, even though I had no education.
You know, you're so right. You're so right on the inspire side, because the amount of times I've seen books come out, you know, men come from Mars, women from Venus or whatever, and there's a buzz around them for a few weeks or months, but then it goes.
It's so true. So to me, aspirations are sacred. It's almost like a Fabergé egg that I've aspired to only, and I take this you through this in the book, a handful of things in my entire life. I mean, we can read a motivational quote on Facebook or Instagram and it's gone within milliseconds, right? We forget it. I suggest and encourage you to set, you know, what legacy? Okay, Dave, here's a good one for you. What legacy do you aspire to leave behind?
Yikes.
Dave, it's your turn.
What I would aspire to would be enough financial legacy that my kids were taken care of. I would like to leave some positive things, some small positive way that I changed the world. I mean, you know, you go back to when you're 18 or 19 and you're leaving school and you know everything. I mean, you are so knowledgeable about everything in the world, and you're going to change everything, and you're going to fix climate and fix all the politics. And then you get to about 30 and you realize I knew nothing. And it's not till you get to about 50 that you actually start realizing that you're learning something of the world. I don't know. I think I'd like to know that my legacy were four well-rounded daughters that have a nest egg, and in some way I affected or changed the world in some small way that was positive.
So that leads me to a little further explanation as to legacy. Legacy, you'll be remembered for what you did for somebody else. No legacies are built on what you did for yourself. So when you stated there that I want to be remembered for, or want my legacy to be, you know, creating four well-rounded people and your daughter for the world, there you've done something for somebody else. And I'll tell you, I have been, you know, you've read the bio. I've been on thousands of radio and TV shows, and I will not be remembered for the beautiful houses I built, even though I was on Oprah for these kind of things. I will be remembered, if I'm remembered at all, for the self-sustaining villages that I build for the poorest country, in the poorest country, for the poorest people in the world, that being Haiti. That's probably my legacy, and I didn't intend it to be that way. Why? Because the generations of the Haitian people that we will have impacted, I mean, generations of youth growing and now having a self-sustaining existence and passing that on to their children, when again, I wish we were visual here, but children in Haiti, imagine your daughters, if this was a hamburger, you know, eating dirt flavored with bouillon and lemon juice. Mm. They're eating dirt over there. And by us going over there and building these self-sustaining villages that we've done now for 18 years, and we've saved the lives of over 12,800 children, that's the legacy, right? That's it. That'll be it. It won't be what I got attention for. I could get very little media coverage for what we do in Haiti. I don't care. I mean, that doesn't bother me. I need the coverage to raise money. That's why every book that I sell, including the new book, all the proceeds go to the Caring House Project Foundation.
Can I ask, because I'd love to go back a bit more to the book, but because we're talking about Haiti, we see it all the time. There's so many different parts of the world that, you know, need different programs. Why for you did you pick Haiti? Was there a connection there? Was there a story that happened that made you go, oh, this is where I want to invest time?
So I'm a simple energy. I'm a simpleton. I'm a linear thinker. Again, going back to going to four high schools in 4 years and not going to university. The two simple answers are, when I was a maintenance worker first moving to Florida, I worked on a golf course. I was 18 years old. I was proud to have a job. I don't believe in the welfare system or the welfare mentality, entitlement. I don't believe in. I was happy and proud to have a job. I worked amongst Haitians, and I was, they called me the white Haitian. And that, people, when I say that, they laugh at it. But the reason they gave me that nickname is Haitians have a very strong work ethic. And here I was working alongside the Haitian people. And I was proud to have a job. I worked hard. And I just felt back then I was so impressed by how hard they worked at the most menial maintenance job on a golf course. That was the first part when I was younger and impressionable. And the second is Haiti is literally 2 hours from my shores here. So I can get there. I don't export anything and I don't take any volunteers over there, but I can keep an eye on our investment. I shouldn't say investment. Well, it is a business, Maeve. What I build for a living on the ocean, my return is financial capital. You know, it's money. Over there, it's human capital. How many lives can I save determines how much profit I make. Not money profit, human life profit. So being relatively close to a very corrupt country and be able to keep an eye on our donors' money as we will have just started our 29th self-sufficient village in the last 18 years.
So that is some legacy.
Well, and I think I read this recently of for New Year's resolutions, they did some research and discovered, you know, for most people in January, New Year's resolutions kind of just disappeared a little bit, combined in with what you were saying about motivation. But the research showed that what lasts the best is when you do something that helps others. When you find some cause yep. or something that you can do that helps others, that is the most sustainable new move you can make with your resolutions in the new year. And I thought it was an interesting
I was on Fox News for that very on New Year's Eve. I was on Fox News, the national program of Fox News. And the title of my little appearance was Set New Year's Aspirations, Not Resolutions. Because if I say I'm going to set a resolution to lose 10 pounds or something, of course you're not going to do it. Or you're going to do it, you're going to gain it back. But if I say I aspire to make an impact in Haiti this year, you will do that. You will follow through with that. So you're right, Maeve, out with the old, literally at the end of the new year with the resolutions, in with aspiring to fill in the blank. I want my four daughters someday, I aspire to have them go over to Haiti or go to whatever poor countries in your regions and make an impact, because then I will have passed my beliefs, you know, that I do believe to whom much is entrusted, much is expected, which is a biblical passage from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 12, verse 48. That's a mantra that I live by. And I've passed that to my daughter, who will then take that torch and carry it on to the next generation. That I think I can be proud of.
So can I ask, in some ways though, what's the difference for you between to aspire or aspirations? You know, people have lots of aspirations of wanting things, you know, the bigger car or the bigger house. Very often they're material things, or the higher job, or to be the manager. What's the difference, or what change needs to happen between aspirations actually being more than just dreams, but making them into reality?
So there's a line in my new book that talks about dreams being something that we have when we're asleep. I have aspirations that violently wake me that I may come true. So the difference between if you were to be sitting in a treehouse and you were to say, and I'm coaching you, for example, and you say, Frank, I want to sell a lot of real estate like you, I would ask you why. And you would say, well, I want a bigger house. And I would say, well, why? Well, I want a bigger garage so I can put all my cars in it. I aspire to have more cars. Why? And I keep drilling and I keep drilling. Eventually you get frustrated. You said, okay, Frank, I just want to be happy. That's what I'm telling you. All these whys are leading to the belief that the more cars, the more food, the more clothes, you know, is going to lead to this magical, euphoric feeling of happiness. It's not true. The energy and emotion that we put into acquiring things, the new car, for example, is never reciprocated for very long. The thing does not return the energy that we put into it. What returns it, using Haiti as an example, is just like, I don't go over there to feel good about myself. I don't feel better. I don't feel worse. It's a stewardship. It's an obligation. It's a responsibility. Again, to whom much is entrusted, much is required. And that is so much more fulfilling. You know, that flash in the pan variety of happiness is created by basically taking, and again, we're putting the needle in the arm and the vein in terms of consumerism and materialism, but just like a shot of heroin, not that I would know what that felt like, but it dissipates. What has stayed, and I was materialistic and consumeristic because I made a ton of money when I was very young, and I had the garage full of cars and the, you know, closet full of clothes, but I was depressed. I was lost. I lost all the heart in my soul. or all the soul in my heart, you know, until I realized everybody listening to your radio program has a professional highest calling, meaning God gives you the gift to do something a little bit better than most. Dave is a better radio host than most people. Not everybody, because that would be egotistical, but better than most. Well, I ask your viewers, what's your spiritual highest calling? We all have one. I didn't know that until my late 30s, until we started the Caring House Project Foundation. So those are the differences. If you very rarely will look in the mirror and say, I aspire to have a new car. You'll say, I want a new car. And then if you dig deep and you have that ability and that gift of introspection, you're going to realize the reason you want the new car or the new whatever, fill in the blank, is because there's a void of happiness somewhere. And when I listen, and Dave, you'll appreciate this, I drive a Yugo.
I aspire to one of those, to be honest with you.
Okay, because I don't know what a Yugo is. I'm glad he does.
it's a small, modest car. It's something Mummy would drive to the supermarket.
I must admit, the eco girl in me aspires to have an electric car.
Well, if you ever watched, you know, like as a kid, the Fred Flintstone, Flintstone cartoons. I mean, a Yugo is basically like what Fred Flintstone drove around in. It is very, they don't make it anymore. They stopped making it in the 90s. But the point is, I don't expect, and I don't care necessarily what I drive. I've lived in the same house for 24 years. You know, in my book, there was a study done a couple years in 2017. 1.7 million people were surveyed from 100 and some countries that asked, you know, what's the definition of happiness? And it really, once you get past $75,000 a year, the happiness quotient, the happiness gradient begins to drop, because the need to pursue more things to fill that void. So, you know, when we realize that, and I like, of course, like anybody listening, I like nice things and I have nice things, but how much food can we eat? How many cars can we drive? How many houses can we live in? How many planes can we fly? There's a limit. And once we reach that limit, then we take that excess and we share it with those less fortunate. And it's just a beautiful cycle.
Actually, some of the loneliest people I've ever met have been owners on super yachts who've got to a stage. And one owner I became quite close friends with, where they just can't trust people anymore. They feel that, you know, they've been exposed to so many people who don't want them as a person, but want them as access to power or access to financial wealth or position. And you'd be surprised how many people that, you know, that they aspire to that billionaire success, and it ends up isolating them away from, you know, where they find true happiness, or whether they even manage to find it.
You know why? I talk about this in the book. As humans, again, we don't handle excess well. An excess of anything, we don't handle well. Excess food, excess gambling, excess money, excess drug, whatever the excess is, other than love, it's the one thing we can handle in abundance. So, like, one of my mentors was Rich DeVos. He was the co-founder of Amway. He was the 60th richest person in the world. He wrote the foreword for two of my books. He lived down the street. He became a mentor of mine.
Is he related
and he
to Betty DeVos?
Was the one. Yes. No, Betsy DeVos.
Yeah, were they related?
Yeah, Betsy DeVos was his daughter.
Ah, okay.
But Rich just passed. He was over 90 years old. But he was the one who really, you know, drove home that point to me. And, you know, he had billions of dollars, but over his career, almost like going to the gym, he conditioned himself to be able to handle what you just described from your super yacht owners, is this disconnect from the masses, you know, the way that the rest of us live. And that turns into, like you said, paranoia, and everybody's out after. He had to condition himself to think differently over decades and decades of building wealth, because he founded, you know, Amway back in the 50s. And he was the one who taught me how to realize that you, Frank, have a spiritual highest calling. Go out and find it. And when I met him, was right when my first book came out almost 20 years ago. I asked him to write the foreword, and I was lost, Dave. And he helped me find that spiritual highest calling. And that started to condition me to be able to handle excess money. Now, not like his money, but the money that I made, I now knew what to do with it.
Now, here for me, for a short jumping in, was it necessary for you really to have a successful personality that told you or helped you to find this higher calling? Or is it something that people can find as well without a coach or without anybody else? What is your experience in that?
You really know, well, you can't find it on your own. You can believe it and believe that there is a spiritual and a professional highest calling, but you need guidance. You need guidance to find it. And whether it be, you know, a one-on-one relationship with a coach or mentor, you know, a lot of my mentors, Walter, weren't necessarily people I knew. There are people I studied from afar, people I read their books if I couldn't get in front of them. So you do need that. It's almost like a train in a train station. If you've ever been to a big commercial type train station, you know, those trains need to be repositioned to put on the tracks. Once they're on the track, then they can get going. And that's how I see somebody. You have to first believe that there is such a thing as a professional highest calling, which we know that is, that's what you do for a living. But there is a spiritual highest calling. And the beauty is when you're able to put those two things together, dovetail those two things together. So in my case, being a simpleton, just a very, you know, average intelligent guy, I put together what I do for a living. I build houses for people who don't even need them. You know, I mean, a $15 million house, this guy has houses all over the world. But I provide housing for people who don't have any. So I get to put those two together, and it's really, it probably saved my life, you know, going back 20 years, because I was really down.
It's a nice balance.
Well, as you were talking, I was sort of thinking, you know, we were talking about the one end of those that have a lot, but, you know, for some people, it's not that they have enough, but they have a lot of hurdles. You know, those that are in the bracket of, you know, $20,000 to $100,000. For them, it's not that there's that much extra, or maybe there's extra hurdles, be it health or be it family or be it relationships or whatever. So for those that are kind of trying to figure, okay, you know, maybe I need to aspire, are there kind of some ground basics that you kind of guide people in with, kind of looking at, look, you know, everybody can do this, because even if you don't have a coach or a mentor, possibly there's a few steps you can start to take to begin the process for yourself.
Well, I mean, obviously the selfless promotion would be, of course, to read Aspire. It's 25 Absolutely. Chapters, and it takes you all the way through from that first chapter that says, what legacy do you aspire to leave behind? The book is broken out into five sections. One talks about the difference between motivation, inspiration, and aspiration in five sections. Then the next section talks about risk and fear and how they're associated. There's five chapters. It goes deep, because risk, fear is what's holding most people back from a lot of implementing a lot of the things that we're talking about today. The next section then gets into personal branding, how you build a personal brand. Dave's personal brand, Maeve's, Walter's, and Frank's personal brand. How do we build it? Next one down talks about relationships, romantic relationships and regular relationships. And the final chapter talks, the final section talks about how to find your spiritual highest calling. Maeve, the thing I want to make sure that we're not focusing on here is we're primarily talking about sharing your treasure, you know, your money. This discussion is not meant for somebody who's, well, it is meant for somebody who's sitting on a super yacht, but it's also meant for that 20 to you know, $70,000 earner. I can't tell you how many times I've been told, Frank, when I'm as successful as you, I will share my blessings with other people. And I stop them. And I say, you know, it's biblical. And if you're not even into the Bible, the three T's, time, talent, and treasure. Before we have the treasure, and before we even have the talent, we have the time to share. And that will start to condition you. So for me, I went out and I used to serve meals to the homeless people on the streets of South Florida. All that took was time. I didn't have any talent. I didn't have much money, but I did that. And so when we realized, I don't have to wait to find my spiritual highest calling. Maeve, if I hadn't served meals to the homeless on the streets of South Florida, there would be no Caring House Project Foundation and 29 self-sufficient villages in Haiti. Because I believe God comes down and taps you on the shoulder many times on your life and calls you to more. how to recognize those, what I call those life's tap moments, and how to act on them are critical. The key is just to act and go share that time. Eventually you have a talent. Let's say some one of your super yacht people sitting on their boat and they're not feeling good about themselves. What about you open that boat up once a year for, around the Christmas time to take kids who are in a children's hospital for a ride? That's something where you allow them to experience, and their families to experience something like that. You'll feel fantastic about yourself. And then eventually, once you have a little money, then you can share. Because for me, we coined the phrase philanthrocapitalism, because I don't believe in entitlements and welfare. I believe in taking the best of philanthropy and the best of capitalism and putting together, because charity exacerbates poverty. That's a big word for makes it worse. Mm-hmm. When you take the beautiful inner workings of capitalism and you combine them with philanthropy, like we do in Haiti, we take this philanthrocapitalistic approach, and voila, 12,800 kids are alive today.
And you get a
those are little baby steps that people can take.
You get a self-sustaining solution.
Absolutely.
Frank, could I ask, hopefully it's not too personal a question, how important was the Bible in your development, both of your philosophy and as a person?
Well, I'm a Christian, and it's very simple. My approach is I believe that it's the dogma associated with the word, the Bible, that scares people away. I've read the Bible cover to cover a number of times, and I know it pretty well, but I am disappointed in priests and evangelists and that kind of thing who kind of pound on the pulpit and pound on the Bible and kind of jam it down your throat. It's a very simple equation for me. If Christ were here today with a red jacket, purplish hair, and we can't see, and blue shoes, how would he treat situations in the world today? Pick your favorite. So, being raised a Catholic and having, and in the Bible, they talk about the prodigal son, who is a story about a man who goes wayward, wastes his life. So I would ask you, Dave, look it up if you don't know it, folks that are listening. How many times have you gone prodigal son? Let's turn it into a verb in your life. In the Bible, he did it once. I've done it a number of times. So that foundation for me, and knowing that, I've been blessed with this ability to succeed at a certain level, and my gift, my blessings were not meant for my sole benefit. And I don't think I would have understood that had it not been for the Bible and my faith.
But I had been thinking as you were talking earlier about being aspired, and I was actually also wondering, for some people, religion fits in or their vision. But for many people, I think I say this being raised Catholic as well, that religion and spirituality can be two separate things. And for many people are, and for some people they're combined in one. But sometimes I find when you're in discussions with people and they're talking about spirituality, we all have a different sense of that. We associate it more with religion, but we can still meet our own spirituality even if we're an atheist. It doesn't need to be associated with necessarily the religion you grew up with.
No, but you're right. I think what you're saying is I mean, today, and I get, until the pandemic hit, I did a lot of public speaking, and spirituality is the reference that you hear today. You don't, like, if I were to ask a room of 1,000 people, how many people are spiritual? I guarantee you about 700 hands would go up. If I ask the same group of people, how many people are religious, you'd probably get 100 hands, maybe 200 hands. So, there is this internal bifurcation in the definition between the two. For me, again, just keeping it very simple, there's, I think it was from the Gospel of John, I think, that talked about, sometimes I evangelize and other times I use words. In other words, it's really in your actions that really should display what kind of spiritual being you are, be it an atheist, agnostic, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Jew. That will determine to me, and I'm not the judge, he's the judge, what kind of spiritual person you are. And I, the other thing, again, keeping it very simple, when I go out to dinner, let's say you and I, the four or five of us went out to dinner, the way you treat the waiter, the way you treat the busboy, the way you treat the hostess will tell me a lot about what kind of person you are. Because I don't believe my time is any more valuable than anybody else's. I, as a being taking up air in the world, am no more important than anybody else. And so I think the reason my wife, well, I know the reason she married me and is still married to me is because I pay attention to the invisible, to the downtrodden, to the lowly, to those you will in an airport that are cleaning the airport. And it's amazing. They're literally invisible people as hundreds of people are walking by them. I will take the time to sit there and ask them, you know, how they are and how their family's doing. I taught my daughter that from a very early age. Whenever we traveled, if we were in a hotel, every night we left that hotel, we took out the stationery that they would leave in the hotel room. And I taught her to write a little thank you note to the maid and leave her $5 on the pillow saying, thank you for such a beautiful, clean room. You know, even though we will never see her, those little things like that will tell me what kind of spiritual person you are.
I remember many years ago.
I think this is very important.
I remember many years ago, I was at Flibs in Florida for the yacht show. And I was coming back from a Lursen's party at about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I stopped into a 7-Eleven to pick up some cigarettes. And as I left to go to the house I was staying in, I saw these homeless people down a laneway. And I thought to myself, you know what? I nipped back to the 7-Eleven. I bought a crate of beer. I brought it down the laneway and I said, guys, fancy some beers. So I gave them the crate of beers. Now I'm standing there dressed in a blazer and white slacks coming from a yacht party. And then I realized I'm down a laneway, like you see in the movies, with a whole lot of homeless people, like you see in the movies. What am I doing? But I have to say, I ended up sitting down with them and sharing some beers. And it was one of the most rewarding nights of my life. I actually phoned Maeve from the laneway and she was like, okay,
where are you?
I'll call the police. Just move away slowly. And I was like, no, Maeve, I cannot believe these people that, you know, when you stop and actually get to talk with them, the invisible people, it was one of the most rewarding nights I've ever spent. And I learned so much from being there.
How long ago did that happen?
About 7-8 years ago, I'd say it was.
Think about the number of incidents, any incidents you've had in your life over the last 7-8 years. And look how quickly that came to mind, because it was memorable, because it made an impression on you.
Yeah.
And it changed you. Mm. So the second to last chapter in my book, in the spiritual highest calling section, I didn't write it. I toured the country in that Yugo, 6,388 miles, 23 cities. And I asked a couple questions. One of the simple questions was, I asked my people that I would stop and meet just randomly, tell me your Hebrews 13:2 story. Now, nobody knows what Hebrews 13:2 is. Very simply, be sure to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. And sure enough, if I asked you that question from the road, in all likelihood, the story you just told me would come to mind. Mm-hmm. Because who's to say the people that you bought that beer for and sat with and talked weren't angels? They were sent there to me by God for a reason, to help you engage that side of Dave. And the stories I heard across the United States from people recalling stories when they were 7 years old, and here this person telling me a story, they're in their 40s. Times when you've shown hospitality to strangers, and after doing so or during the process, you realize, oh my goodness, that person or group of people were angels. Not in the sense of the movies, you see an angel, but it's a fantastic thing. And I actually, you know, the book isn't out yet, but it's chapter 24. I'm doing a chapter 24A and 24B because I got so many stories of people who they weren't religious. I just had to explain to them what Hebrews 13:2 said. And then those stories just flowed freely.
You can't count up to 25, can you? Is this a medical situation?
No, I have 25. The 25th chapter is with aspiration, you can change the world. And I tell people how they actually can go about changing the world.
When is the book coming out? And will it be,
and where can we get it?
Order out online? Is there going to be a digital version? How is it happening?
Are you going to podcast it?
Yes, three. It's three questions in one. So the first one is, it's all in all likelihood is coming out in April. I don't know the date yet. Books actually have seasons. So you have a winter reading season and a summer reading season. So this will be out before well in advance of the summer reading season, which typically is April. Yes, there will be digital. It will be on Audible. I'm actually going to record it myself in the treehouse.
Oh, great.
So I'm going to, it'll be clear it's coming from me, and it's going to be more of a conversation than me kind of reading you a bedtime story, you know, reading every word that's in the book. I'm going to kind of free associate. And you can, as Walter's been helping me do, you can pre-order it now at theaspirebook.com, theaspirebook.com. Mm-hmm. And you can go and see that trailer that y'all saw, which was the, you know, the release, the reveal of the book cover. But the other cool thing is, and we're talking about sharing your blessings, for every book I sell, I can provide 200 meals in one of our villages to the orphans that are eating those dirt patties. I mean, even if you're not into reading, buy a copy and give it to somebody who could benefit from Aspire. Buy 10 copies. If you buy 50 copies, by the way, you can spend some time with me in the treehouse one-on-one. And I don't know how I'm going to fill all those because we got a ton of 50 copy orders. I should have raised the stakes and done 100, but for every 50 you sell,
does that include
you can come
flights?
To Florida. No, it does not include flights.
Just checking.
Although for Walter, it may include a flight because he's doing an amazing job, you know, promoting Aspire.
Thank you. But actually, that leads me to an idea.
I'll be his plus one.
No, not that one. But I'm thinking about Dave, you and I. We have some connections to the yachting industry. Maybe perhaps we find somebody who has a big yacht that we can bring in a little bit more people than in a treehouse as also a sideway to make it happen, that part as well. So we can find someone even somewhere in Florida near Miami or wherever.
Yeah, Palm Beach area.
Let's do it that way.
We're not Monaco here, but we're the yachting capital of the world. You know, South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Palm Beach. There a lot of the houses I sell, by the way, especially in this little town called Manalapan, which is between where I live and Palm Beach, they have docks behind. So the house is on the ocean. Then there's a road, and then behind them is the intercoastal waterway. And there's docks. There's mega yachts parked at these docks. I've sold houses to people that were very wealthy that had yachts. So,
and they look so cool.
That's
well.
A great idea.
They look so cool. We have these beautiful houses, and then the back garden, and then there's super yacht. That was one of the first things that grabbed me in Fort Lauderdale. Was like, wow, that works.
Yeah, it's pretty rare, Dave, to have a house on the beach. And then you have this A1A, the Ocean Boulevard, behind the house. So, you know, the cars aren't running in front of your window. You're looking at the waves. Mm-hmm. And then just on the other side of the road is your dock. There's a handful of places in the world that happens. In South Florida, there's two communities. One is Manalapan, one is Hillsborough Beach, where Jim Moran from JM Lexus, you look him up, he had a beautiful yacht that was on the other side of the road, and his house, probably $50 million house, was on the beach.
It's a place that I was blown away when I got there first. What time? We're unfortunately not too far away from the top of the hour, which is a shame. I could certainly go another hour. Maybe a suggestion for book number 8, would it be? How to build your own treehouse.
I could have started another side business. The number of people I've had in this treehouse over the years, because we use it as a fundraiser. And what happens, Dave, is let's say I brought you, Maeve, and your four girls up here. You would forever hate me because all the way back to Ireland that your girls would be saying, Daddy, build me a treehouse. Daddy, I want a treehouse just like Frank's. And I can't tell you how many phone calls I've gotten from people saying, Frank, you got me in so much trouble because now I got to build a treehouse just like yours for my kids.
Yeah, we're fortunately blessed at the moment, though, with only a teeny tiny apple tree. So it would be quite a lowly structure.
And one of them's got a head height.
Yes, one is afraid of heights. So we wouldn't have to build it too big to fit them all in. Frank, it was such a pleasure to talk with you today. And Walter, thank you for letting me interrupt Devil's Advocates.
It was very inspiring.
I did want to take the opportunity to get to meet Frank in person, having, read up a little bit. I'm delighted to have chatted with you today. So thank you, Walter, for sharing your show.
Well, thank you, Walter. And I'm a Richard.
I appreciate it very much because it is worth. And I thought it has to happen now. There is no time to wait because the book inspires me already, even though I don't have it. But I thought it's a very big value also to share on the Super Yacht side. Maybe there are some insights and some actions that will take place now based on that hour we have had with you, Frank and Dave and me.
Frank, thank you so much. It's been really has been inspirational meeting you, and hopefully we can get you back on the station, maybe near the launch time or something. But thank you for your time. It's been great having you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Frank, for your time spending here.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You've been listening to The Devil's Advocates. Thanks for being with us. Plenty more to come on Super Yacht Radio.
You're listening to Super Yacht Radio.